Please note that the information and advice provided via the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed or substituted for professional medical advice, counselling, or any other type of therapy or professional advice. I do not provide specific medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. And if you have any concerns about a medical condition, please consult with your GP or other qualified healthcare provider. Please do not disregard professional medical advice or delay seeking it because of something you've heard whilst listening to this podcast. Hi everyone, I'm Rada.
And I'm Giles.
And we're your trusted guides for the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast. The podcast that helps you remember, relearn, rediscover and be inspired by others about what might help you feel good on this journey that we call life.
And we're starting right now on our journey to discover those things you forgot were good for you and inspire you to remember them. So without further ado, let's talk about this week's theme.
Our guest on the podcast this week is none other than Bobby Siegel. He's a school maths teacher and Cambridge University doctorate student. And before moving into education, he was an investment banking trader at Lehman Brothers and Nomura. He's also an ambassador for the charity National Numeracy and a presenter for an Open University course on personal finance for young adults. You may recognise him because he went viral on a university challenge and also presents a BBC TV series, Monkman and Siegel's Genius Guide to Britain. And it's an absolute delight to have him here on the podcast this week.
Well, Bobby, it's fantastic to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start, if I may, by asking you a bit about your journey, because it's a fantastic story. Tell us a bit about where you grew up and how you got to doing what you're doing now.
Yeah, so I'll probably start back with my parents. My parents are South Indian from a state called Kerala in India, and they moved to the UK, in fact, East London in the late 70s, 80s. We grew up on a council estate in East Ham, very proud of being from East Ham. I still live in Newham. I live in Stratford, so not too far away. And then growing up, again, East London historically is definitely getting better now, but was quite an economically deprived area. Schools weren't so great. But the thing that made a big difference in my family, so I'm one of four boys, is that every Saturday, our dad used to take us to our local East Ham library. We'd sit there for hours reading all sorts of books and return back home in time to watch West Ham lose on football field. That was always inevitable.
Oh, poor West Ham.
No. They're not so bad these days. So there were Saturdays in the library. And actually, to be honest, I did go to a good state school as well. And then when I was 16, I got a scholarship to Eton College, which is obviously like going from a council estate where you're wearing like Reebok, Adidas and Kappa to like Eton. Yeah. So I think I was like, I described myself as like the Indian version of the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. So then I went on to have a gap year working in the city, started out at Oxford doing maths, actually didn't complete my degree at Oxford. That would be an interesting story for maybe today. Went to Royal Holloway, completed maths and economics, and actually started out a career in the city. So initially I thought, I'm a young, hungry, financially capable graduate. Let's earn lots of money in the city. And I actually worked in the city for a while. Like Lehman Brothers, although, was not a great choice of bank to be a trader, because with a bit of economics knowledge, remember, they collapsed. I remember
Monday. That wasn't you, was it, Bobby? Come on. Yeah.
The thing
Come
is,
on.
I actually Confessable. Worked in the department that partially was responsible. So,
okay, Charles, you need to edit that bit out.
Bobby Siegel's responsible. Then I worked for a short while in a bank called Nomura as a trader as well. And then a little sidestep into PwC as a chartered accountant. And my dad, actually, of all the things I've done, he's most proud that I'm a chartered accountant, because in Indian families, like, Radu, no, like the pinnacle is sort of like being a doctor. So now things like engineer, dentist, lawyer, chartered accountant is on that list. Isn't the Premier League of professions for Indian families?
I can vouch for that. Yes, I can.
So my dad is very proud of that. But the sort of epiphany moment, Giles and Radu, was when I was at PwC, I took a sabbatical. And normally people take, I would say, the sexy sabbatical. They go to like Johannesburg or Sydney or New York. Whereas I put my hand up saying, I'd like to work in the teaching and training department. I was like, oh, we're massively sort of undersubscribed for that. So I worked teaching new graduates, and I loved that so much. I thought, actually, where can I do teaching more fully and actually influence people even more? Go into education. So at the age of 30, I gave up a well-paid city career to move into education, did my teacher training at Cambridge, my PGC, my master's. And this is where, like, at the time, actually, I was the head of department in a state school in London, an unexpected life turn. And I've always been, again, because of reading, I've always been good at knowledge. I've never really been a pub quizzer at that stage. I went on University Challenge, captained Emmanuel Cambridge, unexpectedly went viral. And then on the back of it, I had a, you know, a BBC TV series, a Channel 4 game show. And yeah, now I have sort of a public role as a, still an educator, but someone that's like a positive role model for education, maths and science. And so now I sort of balance this dual career of I'm a broadcaster, but I'm still a class teacher that actually teaches, albeit part-time, real students. So I love the sort of platform I have to sort of, I describe myself as like a positive role model for education.
Wow, what a story, what a journey. My goodness me, that's incredible. And actually, when I was Googling you, just to kind of read a little bit more about you, I obviously knew you, but I wanted to find out a bit more about you. One of the top searches was, does Bobby Segal still teach? So the answer is yes to all those people who are searching and Googling that question. You are. And I think that's really lovely, actually, because I think it's very much that sense of kind of being based in authenticity and real life and still doing that thing that you're most passionate about that gives you probably that energy and that, because when you broadcast, you can tell there's that authenticity, you can tell there's that realness, there's still that passion. I think that probably comes maybe from you, the fact you do still teach.
And I think we're on the pulse of what's going on as well in education.
It makes a big difference because I think I know lots of good education consultants, for example, that come to schools and talk. But after a while of being away from a school, 3, 5, 10 years, and maybe a couple of generations students have gone through, then actually you sort of lose touch with how, obviously people have children, but being a parent is different to being an educator in a class because children at home are different to children in school.
Yeah,
they certainly are. So that genuinely keeps my finger on the pulse.
I can probably liken that, because obviously I'm still a doctor and do broadcasting, but I definitely can relate to that in that, if you're not there, you're not seeing actually what's going on and what the impacts are and what people are going through, you can't really then go and broadcast and talk about it. So yeah. I love that about you. There are many things I love about you, Bobby, but one thing is your authenticity, your warmness, like just how much energy you bring to things. And you were talking there obviously about how, that particular passion for motivating people is something that really is one of the things that you love the most. Just tell us why motivation? Why is that such a big thing for you?
So growing up, again, we grew up in a modest council estate in East Ham. And I think my father in particular, what he always told us was that you obviously there are other factors, but you can control your own destiny. You can, on that particular day, you can sit and decide to read and study and talk and converse, or you can watch telly all the time. So to be honest, our dad did, to be fair, allowed us to watch lots of lowbrow telly. We watched like some highbrow, like Blue Peter, News Round, Biker Grove. My mum did not like Biker Grove.
Biker Grove.
My mum was like, it's immoral. I said, why is it immoral, mum? My mum, I don't know why. But we watched read books, but watch lots of television. But I think our father was always what gave us a sort of sense of, you can choose your schedule. If you want to work this evening, you can work. If you don't want to work, that's fine. The next day you'll find school difficult. So it was that sense of ownership that we always had. And without, again, I think nowadays there's a theory about mindsets that an academic called Cal Dweck from Stanford. And you see in a lot of schools about growth versus fixed mindset. And a growth mindset is where if you take on a task, let's say you're learning to sing or dance or do maths as a maths teacher, and you find things difficult, where growth mindset people are like, oh, actually, making mistakes is part of the process. I can get better. Perhaps I'm not going to be top of the class, but you can be the best version of yourself. Whereas a fixed mindset is where people, in fact, I have a fixed mindset for things like singing. I think, oh, I'm terrible at singing. In fact, when I was 11, I got rejected by the school choir. The
teacher said, no.
His name is actually Mr. Dick. He said, come back next year. And since then, I'm tone deaf. I love chart music, but I can't sing.
There's always a next year, Bobby. It's never too late. Yeah, come on. Yeah.
That exactly.
Put those 10,000 hours in, Bobby.
I know. I'm actually getting the head of music in my school. I've been saying this for the last 4 years. He said he will train me to sing. But I think it's that mindset. So since a young age, I didn't know it was called growth and fixed mindset. But in our family, in fact, all four boys from my current state, we all ended up at Oxbridge. 3 got scholarships to Eton for sixth form. And okay, obviously we have some sort of ability, but I've always believed it's much more about our mindset, our application, that fire in your belly, and also the ability to overcome shocks and be resilient. But that's something that can be developed. Even like resilience and mindset, you're not born with a, again, this is, was it tabula rasa, Immanuel Kant, where we're born with a blank slate. And I sort of believe, obviously, there's, you know, the nature versus nurture debate. And there is, yeah, as the scientist, Vada, you know, yeah, obviously we have genes and we have them. But I do genuinely believe our environment, our siblings, our parents, our teachers, they make a significant influence. So that mindset is something that can be developed. In fact, like the first lesson I have with any class since September 1st, we go back this year, I always put a slide up on mindsets and I get students to discuss it. And in fact, I put a picture of football up. In fact, I'm going to put a picture of Serena Wiegmann, the England manager of Euros, because England had never won a major tournament, but she's come through with a different mindset, maybe the Dutch mentality. But I think mindsets can really make a difference in making us achieve a lot more than we think we're capable of.
And she was a PE teacher as well, I believe. So like she's come from education as well. So that's also a brilliant story in many respects, isn't it?
Mm. And I think as well, it just, you know, educate, I mean, when we think about the education system or education in itself and how it's what it's associated with, you know, we tend to think of exam results, grades, you know, all of that kind of academic stuff, which is obviously important, obviously something to work towards. But there is, I think we have kind of missed, haven't we, in not just in that area, but lots of other areas as well. We've missed that kind of holistic kind of sense of what, you know, what is actually education. There's life education, there's the ability to encourage and improve and to support, you know, people's psychology and them understanding emotions and emotional intelligence and life skills. I'm a massive advocate of life skills and I don't understand why, you know, we're taught certain things about, you know, fractions and stuff. That's really useful, don't get me wrong. I know you're a math teacher, so I'm not going to diss fractions. But, you know, how about understanding what a feeling is and how to manage that and maybe where that's come from and maybe what kind of you can do if you feel that way? Like that, those are things which are going to, like you say, set your mindset and kind of help you through certain challenges or not in life. So why are we not focusing more on that? That's what I don't really get.
I completely agree. So often sometimes on media debates, they'll sometimes get me on to say, Bobby, you're going to say that maths is much more important than PE. But I'll say, actually, PE is equally as important. They're like, oh, no, don't say that. Don't say that. You're meant to be. But the debates are binary. It's like Twitter, you know, either one way or the other. But yeah. I think reality is life is nuanced. And I think with education, we're getting better. The pandemic in terms of technology and flipped learning has improved things. But there is still an element of that Victorian style of learning where students, you know, in the Victorian era, when the factory acts are there, so it meant that children wouldn't work down the mines, etc., all the time. Then they needed to keep children occupied. So they created schools. They were sitting rows of 6, 7, 8, 30, 40 students in a class, teacher with a blackboard, writing, you know, with a chalk, and students would copy exactly what the teacher would do, open up a textbook. And obviously we've got tech now, but there's still an element of education where we haven't really moved on from the 19th century, because education is much more than just getting a qualification. Of course, I always tell my students, get that qualification, that's important, but your thoughts, your feelings, your mindset, the way you treat other people, your relationship, how you manage relationships, all these are equally as valuable. And there's a big question about, is it schools' roles? Is it society? Is it parents? But either way, as a society, I think we're letting down our young people, because obviously, I'm never going to say the exam results aren't important, but the other side, the softer skills, they are just as important, because young people, when they enter the real world, they're not walking around with a piece of paper saying, look at my GCSEs. You judge them as a whole person. So actually, there is a side of education where we're letting young people down, I think.
Mm. Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think, you know, I've got two teenage boys, they're going through secondary school at the moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've obviously got the pressures of school, but then you've got the pressures of being a teenager, you know, you've got hormones flying around, anxieties, and obviously we've come out of the pandemic as well. So there's all these different things that they've got to kind of deal with. And it is a very challenging time. I mean, God, I hated being a teenager. And so I'm kind of like, you know, I can feel for them in that respect, but then obviously they've got the pressures of attainment. And I think that is something that, yeah, like you say, it's something that we need to kind of look at a little bit more. In our education system.
Do you think technology's changed? Again, growing up, you know, all of us here, we'd go to school, come back home, and then maybe switch on the telly, have some food. But we were separate from our school and friends. Maybe they could ring the phone.
I was going to say one landline call, night, and you know, me pretending to be my sister, but that's about it. You wouldn't see someone, would you, till the next day?
Exactly. But I think that technology, obviously technology has huge benefits, but the drawbacks are where our young people and adults like us, we're constantly feeling that we're switched on. We've got our social media, we've got our WhatsApps, we've got our texts, emails, work emails. So that sense of, you know, with humans, I think we need time to step away. Like one of my friends is an author called Simon Ong, and he published a book where one of his quotes is, we need to slow down to speed up. People often think, oh, we need to be constantly busy. But actually, to be our most productive, our best selves, you need time where you're completely away from work. It's something, to be honest, I'm not very good at. I'm not great. I don't practice what I preach. I'm starting to learn to be better. Actually, I'm much more productive if I've had a day off, rather than thinking, oh, got to work every single day. But actually, if you're constantly overstretched and you're, again, on your phone and constantly engaged, as humans, we need to have times where we're disengaged.
Yeah, we're not machines. We're not factories. And actually, I'm a bit like that as well, where I'm like, oh, quick, next. And I'm like, oh my God, my dad would often say to me, Roger, you're not a machine. And even machines break down. So you need to chill out.
Well, and I'd also add that sometimes it's a misconception of what we see those things are. So social media, for example, we may see that as a leisure pursuit, but what actually we're going in there, we're seeing quite traumatic things. We're seeing anger, disruption, like things that are actually detrimental to us. And we're putting energy into those things. And they're not leisure pursuits. They're not, it's not, you know, we've all, and also you see, like you talk about work, because we all, you know, we all work in the media and stuff, that we are constantly on. And I think, you know, we went to the family camping last week, and there was we didn't have electric pickup or anything. So we were like, just, you know, our phones ran out of battery eventually, and we couldn't do those things. And actually it was quite sobering, you know, and nice to have that break away from technology. And I do feel, you know, obviously the kids are what they call digital natives now.
Yes.
And they're in there, and that's all they know. But it was lovely to see our children just playing a board game, not having to, like, not being a video game.
You can't beat a board game.
That's it.
Actually, on that, there's an author called Cal Newport. He's an academic from the University of Georgetown. And he is saying, actually, the superpower for people that want to be sort of the best version of themselves in this century is people that can practice deep work. In fact, his book is called Deep Work: Rules for Success in a Distracted World. And he said that nowadays, there's so many things competing for our interest, whether it's social media, whether it's streaming, whether it's Netflix, whether it's our multiple music services. So actually, the people that will be able to make achievements in whatever career they choose are the ones that can actually focus on tasks. My students, again, when I teach maths, sometimes they expect me to like make my lessons like a Netflix show every day. Like, I don't, to be honest, I have lessons that are fun, really engaging. I talk about the maths of football, the maths of Bake Off, and
I even, would like, love some to have you as my maths teacher.
Yeah, but not all my lessons. Some of my lessons, hopefully my students aren't listening to this, but they'll be like, some of my lessons are a bit dry. They're like, we're just having to learn this. You're gonna have to practice this skill. And students really struggle at that, because when you tell them, okay, half an hour, focus, silent work, I want you to really practice your Pythagoras, make sure you can work out how to calculate the different sides, and they struggle within 3-4 minutes. They're like, they want to have a chat, have a conversation. So the art of deep work is something that's being lost, because we're so overwhelmed by stimuli all the time.
Yes. And I guess our ability to be motivated, or to motivate ourselves, or to be inspired to be motivated by someone else, that is fundamentally based in our ability to have space and sort of time around that, isn't it? And to actually be creative, because creativity, I think, is very much related to motivation. You know, if you're burnt out, if you're tired, if you're overwhelmed, if you're distracted and you're multitasking, then actually you can't motivate yourself to do anything. But I'm interested in your view of, you know, you talk a lot about motivation and engaging people and sort of, I suppose, empowering them with the skills to make their own choices and to be more aware of what they want. What would you say are the kind of top skills in terms of being a good motivator, or what do you think are the key things to motivate someone, or even to motivate yourself?
Yeah, I would say it's a couple of things. One with motivation is try to find where the interest of the person is that you are trying to motivate. And again, I'll use my maths teaching as an example. sometimes in maths, academics, we can be like ivory tower. Our subject is incredible. People should admire algebra for the sake of it. And if students don't see it, well, they don't like algebra. What's wrong with you? But you could do that. And I know academics that do that. But I think the way to motivate people is to find out what are they interested in. Again, if I've got students that like football or students that watch Bake Off or students that watch Strictly Come Dancing, I'll try and define the maths in those. And obviously not every lesson will be based on that, but then I'll say, let's do a lesson working out averages on Strictly Come Dancing. So in September, I've got some of my students, girls and boys, who really follow the series, and we work out the averages and say, how much they need to improve. If they improve by 10% each week, will they be able to get 8s and 9s by week 7? And then they're like, oh, that's percentages. That's maths. That's calculation. And then when we come back to doing, okay, now let's try and put that in algebraic terms. You know, if one dancer has double the score of the other, X and 2X, then they're more inclined to try things that are out of their comfort zone. But I do think with motivation, one, there's an element of trying to find out what their interests are rather than like, this is what I think motivation, what should motivate you. But the second part that I think is quite important is the element of humility from the educator, the person that's motivating. Because I will often make a point of, if I make a mistake, I will draw attention to it. Because I remember in the early days of teaching, if I made a mistake and I was being observed in the lesson, I'd be like, oh my God, I made a mistake on the board. I've written 3 times 5 is 10. So I honestly, on Pointless recently, Celebrity Pointless, I made a really bad error. So there was a mathematical error. So I think my teammate got an answer that was worth 27 points. And I had an answer that was worth 4 points. And I said, that's really quirky, Richard, because 27 is 3 cubed. What did I say? I'm trying to work out what the mistake I made was. Hold on, let me get it.
You're trying to be wrong, but you can't. Yeah, yeah.
I know. Okay. I think the number 9, I said, that's very cool. That's 3 cubed. And it's not 3 cubed because 9 is 3 times 3. It's 3 squared. And I made a mistake and it made the cut. It made the edit. And obviously everyone assumed Bobby must know what he's talking about. And on Twitter, as Twitter is like, I thought this guy was a math teacher. He won't educate my children. That came through.
That's when people started Googling, is Bobby still a teacher?
He can't do basic arithmetic. But I will show this clip to my students in year 7 to 11 to 13. Because I think when you show people that, even if you're a motivator, you're the qualified educator, if you show humility in the mistakes you make, it makes them feel more comfortable in making mistakes. But I think one element of mindset is people often struggle in school or in life where if they make a mistake or they fail at something, then they like hide. They scrunch themselves up into a ball and say, I don't want to experience failure again. Mm-hmm. But actually, if their role models, their teachers, their educators, their parents show, actually, I'm human too, I make mistakes, it makes them feel so much more comfortable in trying to make mistakes. And actually, I messed up in this test, I didn't pass, it's fine. Even my teacher can't get 3 times 3 times 3 on national TV. So, things can't, that could be
well,
possible.
I'm very impressed you didn't slip them a fiver, the editors, the producers. So look, can you just leave that bit out, please? But I guess also, so I do some teaching of medical students, undergraduate medical students as well. And I've always loved teaching. And I think actually, I feel like my broadcasting work and media work is actually sort of teaching, but sharing. It's sharing because in both of those roles, and with patients as well, I learn from every single person that I teach or I hear from on the radio or TV or whatever. So I think it's a two-way process, which is why I love education and teaching so much, because actually every single person I encounter, if I have my ears open, I learn something from them, and that helps me in my life. And I often find, particularly with like the broadcasting media work, if I'm going through something in my personal life, some caller or something will happen or someone will say something, I'll just think, God, I need to hear that myself. Or I actually find myself giving advice that I actually need to take myself. And that's what I find so fascinating. It's a two-way process. So when you're motivating students, do you find actually you get motivation from them as well?
100%. In fact, one of the reasons I obviously enjoy my broadcasting work, but I do prefer the teaching, because I think there's an element of, also with young people in particular, and anyone you're generally teaching, with young people, they've got this optimism, almost like blue skies naivety about the world. Because as we get older, we become cynical, we face rejection, we've got mortgages to deal with, energy price, all these, like, life is there. Life is not easy. Life can be beautiful, but not easy. But young people, they seem to think they can do anything. And sometimes, like, you need to check, hold them back and go, hold on, you're not going to become a number one pop star when you're 15. Maybe some of them will do, but they've got this optimism that I absolutely love, because sometimes life, we can limit ourselves. We sort of put barriers, think, oh, actually, maybe I shouldn't learn to sing, or my dancing's terrible, my cooking. These are all things I can't do. I'm outlining my inadequacies. Like my cooking's not great. But with young people, they think, oh, sure, sir, you can learn this summer. Like one of my students is incredible. In fact, a few of them are incredible at Rubik's Cubes. And weirdly enough, despite the fact I'm a mathematician, in fact, despite the fact that on Rubik, he has a book, the only book he's ever released, and I'm actually on the back of his book as a quote, like, on puzzles. I can't solve a Rubik's Cube. And my student's like, sir, just 4 weeks, spend an hour a day, you can solve it. Embarrassingly, though, I haven't started that much. I've had 2 weeks of the holiday. I will learn. I will try and learn. But I think young people have this optimism. And even though, obviously, the real world is a bit more nuanced and is a bit more grey, not black and white, I think all of us could do with the optimism that our young people have, because the world, you know, if you look at our social media, there's so much negativity. Negativity sells. The media lives on it. The mainstream, the broadcast, they put negative titles and inflation worries. And when there's good news, they try to tuck it away. I think there should be more showcasing of positive, uplifting stories. And young people, I think, are a great example of that.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And there are a couple of things there where, as you were talking, I was just thinking about the kind of like life skills or life lessons, I suppose, that help us through life. And a couple of words are I think, like, hope. Hope is so important because it gets you out of bed in the morning, doesn't it? Perseverance, just keeping on going, is really important. And then I think self-awareness, that ability to understand yourself, your emotions, your thoughts. But then also choice, you know, and I'm not talking about, obviously, there are, you know, lots of us have very, very difficult life circumstances. We can't always have the choices available to us that we would like or that should be open to us. But I'm talking about the sort of the small day-to-day choices of, right, in this moment, what can I do now that might make something a tiny bit better? In this moment, what simple thing can I do that actually might take me a little bit closer towards that place I want to get to? Which I think, you know, some of those words were really like resonating with me as you were talking. And they're the kind of things which sound really simple, but they're so powerful. And they're the kind of things which really, I think, which motivate us to kind of keep going and believe in that.
In fact, when you talked about being in this moment, I'm going to refer to, so I watched, you can see the back of my background, I've got a Chicago Bulls t-shirt.
Yeah, cool.
So I watched, I was never a basketball fan. I played a bit of basketball, but I watched The Last Dance.
Oh, it's fantastic.
During lockdown one. And one of the things that I remember, the documentary that, in fact, Phil Jackson and Michael Jordan talked about, what made them the best coach and the best basketballer, wasn't necessarily any, obviously Jordan was clearly had incredible abilities, but in terms of height, he was 6'5". There were people in his team needing 7 foot. So he wasn't the tallest player, the quickest player, but the thing that made him, it was almost like what Phil Jackson said was, so Phil Jackson practiced Zen Buddhism. And one aspect of this was being able to live in the moment, because he was saying what you've done in the past, that shot, that the three pointer that you've missed, the foul that you committed 2 minutes ago, that's done. That's history. That's written. What will happen in 5-10 minutes, you have no idea, you know, that the game could change, but you can control what you do right now, the choice you make. So when the ball comes over to you, you can control that choice. And what made Jordan, actually, according to Phil Jackson, a better basketball player than anyone in the era, was his ability to live in that moment. So again, Vlado, you were talking about choices. Obviously, life is complicated. It's very difficult right now for many people, but what you can control is what you do right now in the next few minutes. If you can make choice that you feel you're comfortable with, actually, if you accumulate them, then you start having the life that you know, a more hopeful and optimistic life.
I really love that. Bobby, I'm really fascinated to find out what motivates you. How do you motivate yourself? Because well, I'm always interested in, so for anyone who like gives something to other people, like you do to your students, how does that reflect back on you? Like what motivates you to get up and out of the bed? Obviously today it's to talk to us, clearly, which is understandable.
Of course.
But what motivates you in life?
So this is a question about the nature of motivation, intrinsic or extrinsic. So like extrinsic is if you get like a reward, and you know, like your parents, when I was younger, I think my parents were rewarding me buying football stickers. To be honest, I'm a grown man. I want to get
that this week.
I still collect stickers.
That's a Premier League kind of sticker book, by the way, for everyone listening. Yeah. That Bobby just held up in front of us.
I'm going to get one of those this week.
definitely good choice, yeah. But there's also the intrinsic, like what motivates you when there's no sort of external validation of it. But this is where, okay, so when I help people, so ever since I've been in primary school, I'm the kind of person that at break time and lunchtime, I would stay a bit extra behind to help my friends do their homework or they needed some help with some reading. And it's weird because someone might go, oh, but like my teacher would say, oh, Bobby, you're so kind. That's really nice of you. And of course, yeah, it was a nice act of me, but I felt a buzz. I got like a rush from helping people because when people would say, thank you, Bobby, for helping me with the maths homework, I didn't understand that, but I appreciate you helping with fractions at break time. I feel good about myself. So it's a weird one where am I being selfish in wanting to help people? Because I feel lovely about myself. Like in school, there was a student a few years ago, she was really struggling. And I would stay pretty much half an hour every day after school for like an entire term. And in the end of term, she got me like a giant, honestly, a massive custard cream biscuit. Like the hugest custard. Genuinely,
hang on,
the size
a giant
of my face.
Custard cream?
Yeah, that so, you can get them. Yeah, they're amazing.
But it's also the size of my face.
No.
It's massive.
I mean, Bobby, what you said today, you've changed my life, but that has utterly blow my mind.
Yeah, it was delicious. Took a good few days to eat, but the appreciation from the students saying, oh, Mr. Seagal, thank you so much. In fact, the same student about 2 months ago, now she's at university, and at the time she was sort of written off. People were saying she's from a really challenging family at home, she's probably not going to finish GCSEs, she's definitely not going to do college, and now she's at university. And she dropped me an Instagram DM recently, and if you're a current student of mine, do not message me on social media, I will not respond to you. You left school, you're at university working, maybe fine. But she messaged me saying, Mr. Seagal, you might not remember me, but my name is X and you made a real big difference. So it's though genuinely, wow. For what motivates me is people being appreciative of the efforts you make. And I don't know whether that's like a selfish thing because I like feeling appreciated, but genuinely that's what makes me wake up every morning. Even today, the fact that you're so nice and positive, saying, oh, Bobby, you've done some great things, and you're really nice. I feel good about myself. So I think in a weird way, that's like my motivating factor. And almost like you help people and then they make you make them feel good and then they make me make you feel good as well.
That's lovely, isn't it? That's the basis of humanity.
Yeah.
Surely, that's why we're all here.
Yeah, but it's a virtuous cycle.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's fantastic. Nothing wrong with being kind to one another. And I think, you know, you can give one person some encouragement and it literally can change their lives. Just a few words of kindness or encouragement can change.
It's that thing, isn't it, where people say you never know the impacts you have on someone, and sometimes you never will. You know, because it might be a random person. You just maybe you hold open a door, you smile. You just don't know. Sometimes when we say profound things and we give advice in inverted commas to our friends, we think, oh, that's maybe going to make a real difference. But sometimes it literally is, I don't know, sending someone a song recommendation and that lyric sparks something that makes them cry and releases some kind of emotion for them. You never know. And I think that's what's really beautiful about life and really fascinating and really magical is that actually, you know, if you go out with the intention of, you know, I'm just going to try my best here and be the best person I can, you never really know the ripple effect of that. And that's incredible. And maybe you never will.
And I also think, as you're on this, I always try to make a conscious effort to make sure that I notice people, because we've all been in those situations at parties or weddings or events where there are some people for various reasons are not part of a conversation. But I've always made a conscious effort, because I've had times when I'm a short person, when I was younger, a couple of times I wouldn't get included in conversations. I always make an effort to make sure that if I think someone's not being included or being a bit quiet, I would try and draw them in the conversation. Because I always think, yeah, everyone's got something to offer. It's just sometimes just because you're the loud person doesn't mean you've got the most to offer. The quiet person in the room might actually have the most valuable contribution. So I always think I consciously just make an effort every time I go somewhere, make sure the quiet person also gets their say.
Well,
chat.
I can totally attest for that, because we just spoke about that off air. That you and I met at a screening of a Louis Theroux documentary, and I was literally didn't know anybody there, and you came up to me and spoke to me, I was so appreciative of it. It was so lovely. So I've been, you know, I can vouch for that.
Totally. Yeah, we've got evidence here. We've got evidence here. Everyone who's listening.
And it did. Do you know what? But it did really make me feel good about myself, and in that moment, not feeling alone. And then actually set me up, honestly, and I'm not just sort of exaggerating this because you're here, but set me up for the rest of the day. I felt good and felt like I could do that in return to if I was in a similar situation. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Jen. Mm. Oh,
So Bobby, obviously this podcast is Things I Forgot Were Good For Me. Mm-hmm. So what would your one thing be for everyone who's listening that maybe like we knew when we were little, maybe we never knew, maybe it's got squeezed out as we got older. Like what was that one thing that maybe you feel would support people bringing a bit more of that back into their daily lives?
Okay, so actually I'm going to refer to a quote from a film that I really love. Have you seen the film Equalizer with Denzel Washington?
Yeah.
He's a character, Robert McCall. Okay, you need to watch it on Netflix or whatever streaming service you use. So the quote he made in the film actually has a historical precedent, but I'll tell you the quote in the film. And the quote is, progress, not perfection. So progress, not perfection. And there are various routes. The French philosopher Voltaire, the Chinese thinker Confucius, all had versions of this. I think the Voltaire version may have been better a diamond with flaws than a pebble without, or perfect is the enemy of the good. And generally it is in life, when we're younger, we will just like, we'll draw silly paintings and pictures and show our mom and dad or our family, oh, look at this picture of our, you know, look at this picture of the house. And it's a terrible picture, but we'll, but the parents will go, oh, that's a good effort. And you keep drawing. Whereas as we get older, we almost become reluctant, unless we're like perfect or something. We think, oh, I'm 100% confident doing speeches or this job. I've learned my social media skills. Oh, I've learned how to do Excel. We never put ourselves forward because we think I've got to be perfect. But I think that mantra of progress, not perfection. Imagine Denzel Washington saying it.
No, we like the Bobby Siegel version.
The Bobby Siegel version.
We don't need Siegel Denzel Washington. We just need you.
But I generally think in life, obviously, again, progress, again, as a mathematician, is not a straight line linear chart. Progress can mean occasionally going backwards because that's where life's taking you. But it's that concept of if you don't try something, you'll never get anywhere because too many times we look at, again, social media can play a role. We look at perfect lives on social media, people that are amazing singers, amazing footballers, amazing YouTube channels. And we think, oh, I could never be like them. But everyone started somewhere. Even Michael Jordan started somewhere. All the successes. And again, we don't have to be world-class, but whatever, again, your role models in your family, our parents, our siblings, they all had to start somewhere. So I think progress, not perfection is my mantra. To be honest, I don't think I've used that in school, but I will now in September, as well as my growth mindset, I will use that as a picture. And I'll advocate Denzel Washington as well to my young people.
Well, I think you need to show your video of you getting the math thing wrong and then say it.
Exactly. And then obviously play out this episode of our podcast.
Yes. Homework. Honestly, my that's students, they will.
Your lesson that's plan for the first
plan
week.
Plan my lesson.
Fun.
We've thank sorted you. The autumn term is sorted. Now you can thank just put you. Your feet up and enjoy the rest of some holidays. Oh, Bobby, it's been an absolute delight
so
to have
much.
You on. Not just because of what you said, but also just you are a lovely, lovely person. You've got amazing energy. And so we're so grateful to have you on. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Bobby.
Thank you so much.
Oh, Bobby, we like that.
Yeah, thanks, Bobby.
So that's the end of another Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast episode. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope it's inspired you to go looking for all of the things that might help you feel a little bit better.
And hopefully we've inspired you to go looking for our podcast. You can find it on all good podcast platforms, probably some of the bad ones as well. You can also find us on social media. Our handle is Radha.
Yes, Giles, absolutely. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Forgot Podcast. So go and find us there. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you for listening and we'll see you again next week.